Hello, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes. On tonight's programme, a Kerry man who's about to set off sailing solo around the world, and Irish lighthouses and the people who kept them. The Golden Globe Race is a single-handed solo race around the world, but using technology only available when the race was first run back in the 1960s. Gregor McGuckin was the Irish entrant in the last race 2 years ago, and the next circumnavigation will also have an Irish entrant. He's Pat Lawless from Ballyferriter in County Kerry. Helen O'Riordan went along to meet Pat in Ballyferriter and to hear about his preparations for the race.
The first Golden Globe race took place in 1968 with the aim to be the first ever attempt to sail solo non-stop around the world. September 2022 will see the next race set off with 35 entrants. Pat Lawless from Corcaguina, West Kerry is one of those entrants. The route via the Five Capes covers 30,000 miles over 9 months with no outside assistance and no modern technology. Here, Pat, the only Irish entrant in the race, tells us about what inspired him to enter and how he is preparing for it.
About 2 months before the start of the 2018 GGR, my brother John rang me to say that the race was starting. I hadn't heard of it. So I started to follow it, and I got hooked slowly on it. In the beginning, I thought they were all loopers to do the race. I'm the looper now because I entered. It's a single-handed, non-stop race around the world without any outside assistance. So that means that if you get into any trouble and you look for any outside assistance, you'll be out of the race. Like the Vendée Globe is on at the moment, and they can use outside assistance. If they need help, they have a team of engineers. But it's a retro race in old-fashioned boats, like the 1968 race. It was a great idea because it's affordable. The Vendée Globe would be 4 to 7 million if you want to be competitive in it. So I hope to do this for about 120,000. Yeah, right. It's affordable, like an ordinary tradesman can enter it. But it's a retro race, there'd be no GPS. You wouldn't even be allowed a CD player on the boat, no Kindle, no phone, no technology. You're back to using a sextant and all old-fashioned ways. But we have all the safety equipment in triplicate. I entered it because it's a race, for no other reason, and to do my best to do well in it. I have got a great boat in the Saltram Saga 36. I think it's one of the best boats in the race. That'll give you an advantage. But it's about finding the right weather. I've been able to read the weather. It's all old-fashioned ways. We won't have any weather routing or anything like that. You'll have to be able to use your barometer and read the weather. We will have a paper weather fax that we can look at. Comes in through the SSB radio and all system. The person who will do best in the race will have to be capable and be able to read the weather. So the weather is a huge thing, actually, in it. The wind is your engine. If you can't find the best wind, you won't be able to do well. And you will need new sails, because sails are a part of your engine. Like, so before I go on the race, I'm using different kinds of sails now. I'm buying second-hand sails to try them out. Where you find different people, give you good advice. I'm lucky to live in Dingle, because there's great infrastructure there with the fishing boats. That's a huge advantage, to be able to have the infrastructure there and the help.
And tell us a bit about your background on the sea, Pat.
Well, my father inspired us. He used to take us sailing. In the beginning, it was in the Nave Ogue that the Dollies built in West Kerry. He used to take us out rowing, and then he built the sailing boat and took us sailing. And he used to tell us about Conor O'Brien, the first man to sail around the world, and he brought us to his grave. He was Irish from Fines. So I suppose he inspired us. Then Chichester took off sailing around the world. They got huge attention and kind of caught my imagination. And then the Oster, the single-handed transatlantic races, I used to follow them quite closely and kind of dreamed of sailing the Atlantic. The Golden Globe race, the original one, 1968, I think I was about 12. It didn't get the same attention for me, media-wise, but I did follow it, you know, but not as much as the transatlantic races. And then I used to dream of racing across the Atlantic and around the world, but Ireland was poor at the time. Anyway, the dream disappeared and I got married and had a family and had a great life. And then when the Golden Globe race came, it reawoke it. And it was affordable. I never thought an affordable race would turn up. And delighted to enter. It was the best thing I did, really, even though it's a lot of hassle. And that motivates me. I'm time poor. Absolutely time poor. It's taken up every waking minute of my life, but yeah, but it's worth it. I started to look at different boats, and I was interested in a Lilo 34 South African built boat because it was very reasonable. The person who tried to enter the last race was going to sell it to me at a very good price. There was the Rustler for sale in Loch Derg, and a biscuit that I fancied in England over the Solent. So I was looking for boats then with a good cargo carrying capacity, because you'd have to carry at least an extra 2 tons. You can't stop anywhere, so you have to bring all your food, all your tools, everything you'll need to fix stuff and medicine, everything will have to come with you for the 9 months, so you'll have a decent weight on the boat. Then I saw there was 2 Saltram Sagas for sale in Amsterdam, and I went over and looked at them, and the minute I saw the one I bought, I knew it was the boat, even though it was way dearer than the Lila 34. It was a way better boat and it was worth it. It was in really good condition. So I sailed it from there down to Los Abels to land for the prize given for the last race, and then home. So then I knew what I needed to do to the boat, which wasn't huge actually. So I put in deep cycle batteries and solar panels for power. I put in bilge pumps, and inside the cabin I have done a lot of handles and a bulkhead between the galley and the accommodation. I put a wood burning stove because I had to take out the heating system to was in it. It was electronic. You can't use anything electronic. Above decks, in the cockpit lockers, I have put a false floor in, so that if you ever got a bed knockdown or a 360 or anything and water got in, it won't go into the hull. It'll drain into the self-draining cockpit. From the mast back, I'm running all the lines aft into the cockpit, so in bad weather or any weather, you won't have to leave the cockpit to change the sails. And fitting 2 winches, I'll be doing that in the next few weeks. I'm going to fit a second bank of deep cycle batteries, so I'll have 2 banks, each about a little over 200 amp hours. That means with the solar panels, you will be self-sufficient for all your power. Yeah, so the list is endless. I keep track of where I would be in the race. I have OpenCPN in my laptop, so this time 2 years, I'll be halfway between Cape Town and Australia. The race starts in the Sables d'Olonne on the 4th of September, and you sail down past the Canaries, past the Cape Verde Islands. Down, there's an island in the South Atlantic off South America, Trinidad. You keep to the west of that, down below the Cape of Good Hope, below Australia, Tasmania, New Zealand, and then below Cape Horn, and back up to France, then again.
You make it sound easy, Pat.
Well, it is, yeah. All going well, it will be easier.
And you've already had to do a qualifying voyage.
I did. We all have to do 2,000 non-stop qualifying miles. So I sailed, last summer I sailed down to the Azores and back without stopping. I had a headwind the whole way down, and then the way back I met Storm Ellen. So it was a good test of the boat, and went no problem. I'll use area self-steering, and that confirmed it for me. It really worked so well. I think it's better than the self-steerings with their own rudder. Even though they have advantages in some ways, just personal, but I find the Aries better because you steer with the ship's rudder, which is a better system for me. Now you have ropes that you have to maintain that you don't have on the likes of Hydrovan or that. It'll keep the boat going well, but yeah, I was out in the first line and no problem. Went perfect.
So how long did it take you?
2 weeks to go down to the Azores and 1 week home. I had 1 day with fair winds going down, but light winds, and 1 day with headwinds coming up. So yeah, right. It balanced out, which is, I was afraid when I get down, I'd have 2 weeks of headwinds coming home. You never know, they could turn around, like, yeah.
How are you going to fund all of this, Pat?
I cashed in my pension plan, whatever money I could, so I had enough to buy the boat and actually pay the entry fee, which is $16,000 Australian dollars. So I have that paid, and I have a good bit of work done to the boat. When I came home from Los Abels d'Olonne, I decided to sail up to Limerick for the Riverfest, the May weekend. And a friend of mine, Eamon Andrews, came down to the boat and he said he knew I was going to win. I knew I needed to spend a good few bob on the boat, so I did a fundraiser through Facebook and I took in a nice few thousand as well, which meant that I had enough to do what I had to do to the boat without borrowing money, which is huge for that year. I sailed to the Azores then on my qualifying trip, and I was still without debt. So then, during this winter, my wife came up with the idea of having a raffle. I organised the raffle, but because of COVID, I couldn't have it. So I'm having 4 or 5 small raffles, which will raise another 10,000, hopefully. With what I have to do, that would mean at the end of this summer, I still will be without debt, which is huge. And then I'll have about at least another 40,000 to spend between sales and safety equipment next year, but we'll cross that bridge. Fundraising, I thought it would be a big problem, actually. It's not, and I'm still earning a few bob as much as I can. I'm saving whatever I can, and people are very kind. The Mehill system in Ireland is an old system, and it's still gone down. People are very helpful and accommodating in Ireland.
Well, as I said, Pat, you're a huge inspiration to us all, and we wish you the very best. We'll hear more from you.
Helen O'Riordan with Pat Lawless in Dingle. Pat sounds really well prepared, and we'll be following his progress as he prepares for the Golden Globe with interest. RTÉ has commissioned another series of the TV programme Great Irish Lighthouses. The programmes are due to start filming over the summer. David Hare of In Production TV is making the series. I spoke to him earlier about all things lighthouses, and first about the number of lighthouses we have around our coast.
Yes, it's a figure that sort of changes. It depends how you count them, and it depends how you count who's in charge of them. But I think 70 is probably a good number to kind of have as a general number.
When do they date back to?
Well, the very earliest one is Hook Head, and that goes back to the 12th century. And there was a light there before and a brazier there before. And then there were a few built in the sort of 16, 1700s. And I think by the beginning of the 19th century, there were 15 working lighthouses. And then within a period of about 60 years, a further 50 or so lighthouses were built. So there was a building boom in the 19th century.
Why so much in the 19th century?
I think it's because it was increased maritime activity and trade, particularly transatlantic trade. And there was just the need to protect the ships and the shipping routes. And people just needed better navigation, better safety. The purpose of a lighthouse really is not to warn of a specific danger. It's more of an aid to navigation. And so if you're a ship coming across the Atlantic in the days before GPS or any electronic navigation, you might necessarily know whether you were off the Clare coast, the Kerry coast, the Cork coast. Whereas if you saw a lighthouse, and you might be able to see it 20, possibly more miles out to sea, whether at night or by day, you could then say, that's the Farset, because I recognise the colour markings on the side of the lighthouse, or I can recognise it by the flashes.
Because when you're sailing and you have your paper chart stretched out in front of you, the lighthouse will be marked, but also beside it will be the number of flashes per minute.
Exactly. So it was a very, very useful and effective way of telling, you know, the masters of ships where they were, and they weren't guessing.
And the construction of them, if anybody has been to any of them, the construction work itself is a wonder.
The construction is absolutely extraordinary. And when you think about when they were being built, I mean, some of them were being built, at the beginning of the 19th century, before there were decent roads and even before there were railways in Ireland. And, of course, in the UK, the same thing applied. So a place like the Skelligs, when that was being built, I mean, it was just the most extraordinary achievement technologically and also just a human achievement. I mean, living on the rock, building these things with no motorized help, no diggers, you know, no hydraulics. It was just brute manpower and very, very clever design.
And the people who peopled them, who looked after them for so many years, just on the Skelligs, we played a piece of archive on the programme here some time ago from the lightkeeper and the Skelligs. He remembered when the swimmer Mark Spitz called to see them on the way over to the Olympics in Munich when he won all those gold medals and dived in and swam around for them.
Yeah, no, I mean, they have some amazing story. I haven't heard that story before, but that's that's an interesting one.
But you're looking for people who might help you, who might have memories themselves, who might have old camera footage, old photographs?
Yes, I mean, we'd love to hear from anybody who either worked with or for Irish Lights in a lighthouse or indeed in a lightship. That's very important that we include the lightships in the series. But you don't necessarily have to have been an employee of Irish Lights. You might be a relation of somebody who was, or, as you say, you might have a very deep interest in lighthouses. You might have a collection of memorabilia or basically anything lighthouse connected. We would love to hear from you.
We're going to hear now some people from the first series you did of Great Irish Lighthouses, some lighthouse keepers and their families. First, here's Jerry Butler. He was a lighthouse keeper on Galleyhead Lighthouse.
I was born into the Irish Lights. Both my parents were in the Irish Lights and both my grandparents were in the Irish Lights. So it was fairly pointed or expected, if you like, that I was going to become a lightkeeper. The Commissioners of Irish Lights always wanted people in the Irish Lights who knew what they were letting themselves in for, because it was quite an isolated life. You were going to be spending a lot of time on your own. Even though you'd be out on a rock with two other men, nonetheless, you had to be good in your own company. If lads were packing up after 4 or 5 years, retraining other fellas was quite an expense that, if they could avoid it, they would. That made the Irish Lights then a very traditional job, if you like to call it a job, but it really isn't a job as such, because it's not a place where you go to work and come home. You're at work all the time. It becomes your life. I remember going out onto the very first rock station that I went to, and as soon as the helicopter left the rock, that sense of isolation fell very, very hard down, and I could feel it. I remember saying to myself, okay, you're here now. Get used to it. In the Irish Lights, we moved around from one lighthouse to another. On average, you might spend between 4 to 6 years at a particular station. The very first purpose of a lighthouse keeper is to maintain the light at night. That's the very function of it. However, to do that required a huge amount of other work that needed to be done.
Former lighthouse keeper Jerry Butler, he's still involved in the keeping of Galleyhead Lighthouse as a tourist attraction and a museum. The Commissioners of Irish Lights then carried out regular inspections of all the lighthouses. Sister Mary Keenan was raised in a lighthouse family, and here she is telling the programme about those inspections, with first an introduction.
The Irish Lights ship would come into the bay with quite a lot of the senior members of Irish Lights and some of their commissioners, and they would, you know, physically inspect the lighthouses. The lighthouse keepers would be turned out in their first dress uniforms. The Irish Lights flag would be raised over the lighthouse, and I suppose it was a day when you would feel that the lighthouse was really connected to its service.
I remember them very often because we had them every year. And before they came, there was about 3 weeks of preparation. The house was cleaned from top to bottom. My mother went to great ends to make the house very welcoming. She'd have flowers everywhere. She'd have special bedspreads on the beds, baked bread. She had the house just so warm and welcoming for when they came. It was like an exam. Like, they come in and they examine the house, actually go through the whole house to look at every room. I also remember we were dressed in our Sunday best. You know, we had our best Sunday clothes on, and if we met them, we were supposed to speak to them and welcome them, and so they were very important people coming to the house. I know my mother was very tense until everything was finished and they were gone, and it was like, we can relax afterwards.
One of the things, Dave, that comes out there is the amount of effort which went in by individuals that went into keeping the lighthouses, keeping everything pristine.
Yes, I think there was a great pride in keeping everything, as you say, pristine. And the level of detail in a place such as the Farset, I mean, the fact that there were brass banister rails or handles going up the stairs, there were tiny mosaics in the living area, and all these things really wouldn't have been seen by very many people at all, but they showed an enormous attention to detail, and then they were looked after and cared for. I mean, there were the annual inspections, of course. So the lighthouse keepers knew that the commissioners would come round once a year. And in the previous series, we had family members telling that they would literally go around and rub their finger along the top of the door, along the mantelpiece, to make sure there was no dust. So they were kept in a very pristine condition. But I think there was a great pride in making something look as good as it could.
They're also incredibly photogenic, and you'll see posters of them for sale all over the world. What do you think is our fascination with them?
Well, as you said, they are extremely photogenic. They're usually positioned in very photogenic locations, you know, on stunning parts of the coast. I think there's a romance that people that haven't worked in them maybe ascribe to them, that perhaps that they're not particularly romantic places, actually. But they seem to us to be romantic. I think there's something mysterious about them. I'm not even sure why I got involved, why I thought that this would make a good subject for a television documentary. I do remember thinking that at the time, how amazing it was that it hadn't been done before. You always think, well, surely this must have been done. And then it actually hadn't really been done for at least 20 years. And in fact, probably longer than that.
All of those lighthouses are automated, the lightships are gone. So you're talking really about the last generation of people who lived on those places. Isolation was always an issue.
Yes. What happened in about the 1960s and 70s is that the families stopped moving around with the lightkeeper. So wherever the lightkeeper was stationed, the family tended to go. Not always, but they were given the option. And there are various lighthouse keepers' dwellings dotted around the country. I mean, the ones you might be familiar with, the Crookhaven, there are very nice cottages in Valentia Island, and I'm sure all over the place. But these were essentially closed down, and the families were given, you know, housing allowances. So the family could stay in one place, and the lighthouse keeper would then travel to their station as appropriate. And as, you know, I suppose travel became easier, and maybe things like helicopters, you know, you didn't have to move around with your family. Your family could live where it lived, and then you just went to work.
If somebody may have something, some photograph, some archive footage, how did they contact you?
I think the best way is via email. It's very simple. It's david@inproduction.tv, and we'll reply to you as soon as we can.
And thanks to David Hare of In Production TV. That series is due to start filming this summer, hopefully if pandemic allows. And if you have archive or family material they might be interested in, inproduction.tv is the website, or you can send it on to me, seascapes@rte.ie, and we'll forward it on. The Irish Sailing Awards are usually a kind of glittering night in the sailing calendar, but last night they were held by way of a virtual event. Notable winners were Eve McMahon of Howth, who's Youth Sailor of the Year, and Wild West Sailing in Sligo, which was the Training Centre of the Year. John Leahy of Dunleary was named Volunteer of the Year for his extraordinary work with the Cruising Association of Ireland. John kept up a stream of virtual events for the last year to keep people involved during the pandemic. It was no surprise that the Afloat Sailor of the Year was named as Tom Dolan, whose heroics in the Solitaire du Figaro earned him the prize. Tom is no stranger to seascapes, and he accepted the award from his home in France with typical modesty.
Delighted to be have been elected Irish Sailor of the Year. I was just thinking now, I'm probably the first ever person to have won Irish Sailor of the Year without having laid a foot in Ireland during the year. But at least thanks for accepting me. I would have loved to, but hopefully very soon I'll be back. Next is again the Solitaire du Figaro this year, the first race of the season is in 6 weeks, so I have a very busy year ahead of me. First person, there's a lot of people, I suppose. What I do a lot of sailing on my own, and none of it would be possible without a big, big list of people. I have two sheets of people here to thank. But the first and most important is, I know she's watching, is my dear mother, Anne Dolan, out in Carlinsound, Kells, County Meath. Thanks. Thank you, Mammy, so much for always encouraging me to do what I wanted to do and not what other people said I should do. And I suppose I take this time to apologise for having been a teenager, but I know things weren't always easy, but thanks so much for always being there. I'd like to thank my amazing girlfriend who's beside me now, Karen, she was beside me since the start of it all, and I hope she'll always be beside me for the rest of wherever these adventures bring me. A huge, huge thank you to Jerry Jones, without whom many of this would be possible. Thank you so much, Jer, for being a not only being there to show me how to do the whole business side of things, but also just being there when in the highs and the lows, especially when things weren't going so well, and always being a shoulder to lean on to always encourage me and always keep the morale high. An enormous thank you to Smurfit Kappa.
the really brilliant Tom Dolan, the afloat Irish Sailor of the Year. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're back at the same time next Friday. Everything on the programme as podcast is on our website, rte.ie/seascapes. If you want to contact me or the programme, the email is seascapes@rte.ie. If you're lucky enough to be anywhere on or near the water over the next week, stay safe.